So I am William Baker, and I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio, technically Loveland, but I teach online in the online graduate program out here at Hope International University in Fullerton. This is a Christian church, Churches of Christ affiliated school. And we're one of the chief things I've worked on in my career is Epistle of James. And so we're going to look at sections of it today. One is the, we'll do a short introduction to James, and we've got five passages to look at regarding God answers prayer or doesn't he. I should also mention that I have kind of a very dry mouth condition, so I'll need to be drinking a lot. And also my luggage got lost, so I'm wearing what I wore on a plane last night.
Authenticity.
So I am the worst for wear, really, but I'll do the best I can today. My luggage just arrived on campus a minute ago. So it was touch and go to even get it today. So anyway, just a few things about James. James, in my opinion, was one of the earliest, or the earliest of the New Testament books, New Testament epistles. Varying opinion about that, but I take it that it's really pre-Gentile. It never mentions a word about anything regarding Gentile circumcision, any of those issues that come up at the very beginning of Paul's letters. So I also would hold that James, who wrote this book, is the brother of Jesus, who was one of the chief leaders of the church, particularly in Jerusalem, pretty quickly after Jesus' resurrection. You see him become a chief figure in the book of Acts, primarily the presider over the, it's called the Jerusalem Council in Acts 15. So he, along with Peter and James, or Peter and Paul and John, probably, would be the chief leaders of the church. James himself is killed on the street in Jerusalem in 62 AD. He was killed on the street, as mentioned by Josephus, one of the few Christian events mentioned by Josephus. And he calls James there the brother of Jesus, which is highly significant because it's one of the few references actually to Jesus by Josephus as well. So James is really written in a period where Christianity is primarily Jewish. It has spread to Jewish areas. And one of the reasons I consider it to be lots of things that suggest that it's Jewish, but in orientation. But one of them is in James 2:2, where James talks about a man entering the assembly. The actual Greek word for that is the word synagogue, and we take it that there's a period of transition. You know, the Jews met in synagogues, and that there's a period in which the assembly of Jews takes on the Jewish characteristics of synagogue teaching and so forth. So James, I think, is early. One of the other things about James to be aware of course, is that James is sometimes actually considered a fifth gospel. It is doesn't quote Jesus. Well, we think it does once, but he doesn't quote him by name. But he heavily is dependent on Jesus' teaching. But it's late enough in the stage of James' teaching life that he at times sounds kind of like what Jesus says or teaches in the Gospels, but it's in his own way. And I think this is what you'd expect of a teacher who is, he calls himself a teacher, what you expect of a teacher who values the teaching of Jesus, but doesn't really think of it necessarily verbatim. And he doesn't quote from the Synoptic from the Gospels either, because the Gospels are written, in my view, after James. So James is the earliest witness to the church, the earliest church, and to the teaching of Jesus. So, but we're going to talk about prayer, and one of the important things about the Epistle of James is to think about how to read the book. It's written where topics are brought up at various points through the book. So prayer, actually, James has a lot to say about prayer, but it's in five different places. Put them all together, it's at least a chapter. It's a large portion on prayer. And some of his comments really reflect, as I said, sort of a Jewish prayer. The other thing to think about in terms of prayer, which we don't tend to think of, is that prayer in this period is never silent. They don't do silent prayer. Prayer is always spoken. Silent prayer is much later, the later kind of transition that occurs. But anyway, I'm going to ask you to, since I actually don't have a very strong voice, as you can probably tell, it's very garbly. I'm going to ask you to help me with this. So you need Bibles or some reference to the Bibles, and I'm going to ask you to do some thinking and study yourselves on these passages. One of the things that we discover about prayer in James is that each one of these five passages, we can look for what is being asked for, what is being asked for, what is thought to be best to be asked for, and then also what are the conditions. I think we don't tend to think of prayer as having conditions, but for James it does, and the conditions have a lot to do with you. They're not conditions on God, the conditions on you being most actively received by God in what you're praying for, praying about. So we're going to, five passages here is a bit much to get through in 30 minutes. Okay. But, and I had a handout in my suitcase too, that would have made this a lot easier for all of us. But they just were, you want to come over and get some stuff out of there? I'm going too late. So I have to refer myself to water pretty often here, also here. Okay. So let's start with James 1, 5 through 8. I don't know anybody's name, so I need active volunteers to read things out. Looks like you're ready to go, so please, Christina. And think about what is being prayed for and what conditions are laid out.
If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. But when you ask, you must believe and not doubt, because the one who doubts is like a wave in the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. That person should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Such a person is double-minded and unstable in all they do.
Yeah. Notice the contrast between God gives generously and that person will receive nothing. So this is the easy one in terms of what's being asked for, right? What is it? Anybody, everybody?
Wisdom.
Yeah. So wisdom. But we have to understand what wisdom is. And Jewish frame of mind. Wisdom is not intelligence. Wisdom is not necessarily... Some of wisdom comes out in, say, the Proverbs, proverbial ideas. And what did the Proverbs give us? Kind of guidance.
Practical principles.
Practical principles. Practical principles for what?
For everyday life.
For loving, right. That's what wisdom characteristically does. In every culture collects wisdom, proverbs and ideas like this that are intended to help guide us in simple, easy to memorize attitudes about how to live. I would go a little bit further and say, yeah, it's about how to live, but it's a little bit more what I'd frame as skill in living. Skill. In other words, it's learning, you know, behavior about living, like riding a bike. You learn. And you learn as you go along in some ways as well. You get wiser as you get older, most people do. But I would go a little more specific and say wisdom is also what makes up our skill in living. I would say what activates our skill in living is our decisions.
Like application.
Right? You make decisions about things. And when do we often seek God's help? To help make decisions, right? To make wise decisions. And hopefully we do this every day, but what often we do, we ask God for decisions. And I think as we make good decisions, we build on the ability to make good decisions, right? We can learn from our success, you might say. So we make these decisions and build on them. Now, so it encourages to go up and ask of God. And that God gives generously, well, without reproach. This simply means he doesn't think poorly of you for asking for help. He's happy to give it. But there is a condition. What is the condition?
Faith.
And this doesn't necessarily mean Christian faith. This is more in a Jewish frame of thinking. More like trust. More like trust in God.
It says do not, well, this version says do not waver.
Yeah, and there's more definition to what faith means. You just don't have to sit there and make up your own definition, because he says, as you say, says what?
Do not waver. If you ask him, be sure that you ask that your faith is in God alone. Do not waver. It talks about having a divided loyalty.
Well, what's that image though?
Pine says he must believe and not doubt.
Right, and then what's the little image of doubting?
I'm going to toss seeds.
Seeds. Think in terms of the sea. Right?
Waves up and
there's
down.
The waves, but what's underneath the waves? Even more turbulence. Right? He kind of means that your trust in God itself is always unstable. Let's say you're the kind of person who only asks for God when you're in huge trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do anything for you, God, if you help me now, that kind of thing. But he's talking about that kind of person. Their life is not one of abiding trust. And so he's going to be, well, let's say more attuned to a person like this. You know, it's not for us to judge exactly what's underneath the surface of everybody's life, right? But and it doesn't mean without doubt at the second you're making the prayer. We're talking about a life of faith, a life, or in this case, a life that is just unsteady and unstable in its relationship with God. So the reason I say that is because verse 8, he talks about, further defines this kind of person. What does he say?
They're double-minded and unstable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not double-minded. And not just unstable in everything. So their life is not stable. The word double-minded is phrased in the word mind here is not really the word for mind in Jewish thought. It's really the word for soul. So think in terms of not a person who's divided in their mind, but whose inner self is uncertain about God.
Their loyalty is divided.
Yeah,
should loyalty. Should I trust God, or should I trust myself, or trust something
sure.
else?
Yeah. And then the other thing I would say is, where do we get wisdom from?
Practicality, experiences.
Yeah, well, what kinds of sources?
I'm wondering if it's experience. The kingdom is where the king dominates, and wisdom is where knowledge and understanding dominates. My experience of wrecking the car when I drive it unsafely, I finally figure maybe I better let what I know be in what rules me.
I think that's definitely a foundation here. But I'm also thinking about wisdom as being parted from God through various means, like, let's say, the Bible, or from the teaching of somebody, or the preaching of somebody, or the counsel of somebody, a parent, a friend. God tends to speak through people often to kind of build your life. Not just necessarily directly to you. So you look for the wisdom in places, in people, when you're looking for guidance. And not just necessarily a bolt from God. So, I mean, that's obviously the basic thing that James has to say. We don't have that much time, so let's go on to the next one. And then we jump to 4:1-4. Can we have a reader for that? Start with Walter. Looks like you're ready. Walter, at a glance.
Sure.
So
it's chapter 4:1-4.
Excuse me. I got a call from. And I have to answer. It's from. Hello? Hello? Oh, jeez, this is not an important call. Sorry. Well, we can call some. Go ahead.
King James, okay. From whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence, even of your lusts that war in your members? Ye lust and have not. Ye kill and desire to have and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you have not because you ask not. You ask and receive not because you ask amiss, that you may consume it upon your lusts. You adulterers and adulteresses, know not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever, therefore, will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God.
Okay. So, what is the person asking for here? what should not be asked for. Let's put it negative.
Things to fulfill your own selfish desire.
Yeah. Selfish desire. We say not selfish desire. Then we talk about these is the world there. Not selfish desire. So here's again, you ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives. That's conditions. What are we asking for? Well, I guess we're asking for things, right? Let's call it material things.
Pleasure.
So that's a tough one, isn't it? Because it's, how do you get those motives of this is what I want completely out of out of your request? I don't know that you can completely, but I do think he is saying that you know, you're asking God for things that aren't good for you. And you're asking God for things that are more about fulfilling your own selfish desires than anything else. It's, he even talked about here fighting and quarreling, you're jealous over somebody else's things and what they have and all that. So yeah, you get the coveting thing from the Ten Commandments in here a little bit. Here he even uses the word adulteresses to describe them. Adulteresses is only used elsewhere in the Old Testament prophets to describe the Jews when they do what? Think about it.
Worship other gods.
So this is the category of really worshiping worldly things and not really honoring God. So there's something to be said for having yourself. It's kind of back to almost the opposite of faithful, isn't it? It's another way of talking about being not truly committed to God. And so we have to think in terms of, what can I say, building, again, sort of building a life of a wise life, a life that is able to make decisions. And as we build upon these things, the kinds of things we ask God for, or ask God's help for, are going to be more akin to the kinds of things he wants to answer, I think. Mm-hmm. So those kind of fit together a little bit.
Yeah, it goes back to your double-minded.
Yeah,
thing there.
Sure it does.
And also what Jesus said, you know, about loving money versus...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. So, good. All right, let's tune down in 20 minutes. So there you go. Let's look at the next one, 4:13-17.
I'll read it.
Thank you.
Look here, you who say, today or tomorrow, we're going to a certain town and we'll stay there a year. We will do business there and make a profit. How do you know what your life will be like tomorrow? Your life is like the morning fog. It is here a little while and then it's gone. What you ought to say is, if the Lord wants us to, we will live and do this or do that. Otherwise, you are boasting about your own pretentious plans, and all such boasting is evil. Remember, it is sin to know
what you ought to do and then not do it.
This though gets a little bit to where we were just leaving a minute ago, right? What are we supposed to be praying? What are we praying for? Well, or what are we not supposed to pray for?
Longevity. Living a long life.
Yeah, and what should our request be based on?
It's based on God's will.
Yeah, Lord's will. So on the positive side, we're looking at the Lord's will. So that's a little bit of what I just said a minute ago, isn't it? As we become more wise, we become more attuned to God. And this particular example, I think in this particular case, how do I put it? I actually turn these around a little bit. Kind of conditions would be more like Lord's will, right? We're praying in Lord's will. And the request is really for, let's call it success. Right?
What you going to do?
At the beginning. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What you going to do?
Yeah, these are, this is actually thinking in terms of merchants. Merchants.
Business.
Modern, old, first century businessmen. Merchants tended to, if you think of, if you've been to Europe or been to other countries besides ours where they have these stalls in the marketplace, that's how business was done. Mm-hmm. Paul was one of those people, right? Remember what business he was in?
Okay.
Yeah, so he set up in the market of Corinth and other places that he went to. So businessmen tended to, let's say you did pretty well in a certain place, like all businesses, you think, we've got a good, and remember, items across the world weren't like so easily exported. Let's say if one person was selling basket goods or something like that. Well, maybe they've got a certain design or a certain dyeing that either they use or people they buy things from use. And it's going to be distinctive to that culture, or bowls. And so they think, well, I wonder how it's going to go over to bring this kind of item, which is not even known over in this other place, a little farther from here. Bring it over there and see how success we'll have there. Notice the indefiniteness of how long they would go at this. And how indefinite is even where they're going to go. This or that city, year or two. But it's not saying there's anything particularly wrong with trying to be successful. You know, or wealthy even, or build a good business. But it has to do once again with what? You know, where we are with God. Mm-hmm. Now, remember the old day? I don't know if maybe some of your churches still do this. I remember, lived in Scotland for a number of years, and I remember actually this happening, same thing happening when I was younger, my home church, was that when they would announce the next week's meeting, they would say what at the end?
Lord's will.
If it's Lord's will, remember that? That's directly taking this adage into the life of the church. Now, just saying that doesn't, you know, is not exactly what we're talking about. But the idea of being reminded on a regular basis or in a daily way or in our prayer life with our family or something like that, it's not a bad idea. Mm-hmm. You're going to say something.
It's a humility. That's what I. That's mm-hmm. what I see.
Yeah.
You know, a businessman saying, you know, I'm going to go here and I'm going to spend this much time and it's going to be good. I have a good product. It's going to be good.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's certainly you assuming what the future holds.
Yeah, and maybe not. Maybe it's not going to go well in this particular place.
Is it also keeping it in our mind that if it doesn't go well, it's because God did not will it?
Yeah, there's a little bit of God's providence in this. I'm not going to say Calvinism, but there's providence in all of the Bible, that God has a certain level of control over the future and has certain ways he thinks he's trying to accomplish in certain ways to certain means and people. And hopefully you're one of those people he wants to work with, right? What you're trying to do is one of the things that, among the things he wants to work with.
Like,
but there's no guarantee. Yeah, yeah, look at Paul, right?
Paul
couldn't even get what he wanted. So it's not automatic. It's not automatic. Okay, let's look at 5:4-6. So I did, yeah, the boasting and arrogance, that's the negative, right? So some of this is about bragging about your personal success. I did this, I did that, I did the other thing. One of the things as a teacher, I never have liked to hear teachers talk the way I never liked the thought my whole career. So I've always avoided this by some teachers talk in terms of my class and my classes and me this and I this, and in a sense that they're just really their self-esteem is so tied up in these students who adore them. Paul found that to be a little bit off-putting. I've also avoided the talking about my students like that. Because, you know, they might be my class, but they're in other people's classes too. Stuff like that. So, anyway, that's a little thing that I've always thought of. And,
how does verse 17... it seems like an add-on.
It does, and sometimes James does have sort of an adage at the end of each of these chapters. You'll notice that chapter 3 has a kind of a one like that. It's a common trait of his to wind up with something. It doesn't really fit other than the idea that he thinks as a believer that we know better than this.
Okay, I just wondered.
So I think it's kind of the positive side of this thing, you know. You got to remember this. You know better than this to be like that. And to be honest, one of the things I've examined in the Old Testament is verbal sin. And one of the chief things that the Old Testament harps on, Nebuchadnezzar, the king, Sennacherib, and all that, is always their arrogance. Always. God doesn't like that. Pharaoh. So, okay, let's get moving. 5:4-6. Now, can I get two more readers? One more. Thank you.
Behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you. And the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you.
Okay. He doesn't exactly use the word I have in mind here. What is the prayer for? Who's doing the praying? The moaning, crying, who's doing that?
Laborers,
your workers.
Yeah, and what's happening to them?
In the street.
Not being paid a fair wage.
Mm-hmm.
A wage back in those, you probably heard this, is a denarius. It's one Roman coin per day. And most people lived on that daily. I think in terms of, they don't have refrigeration, they don't have, they're, let's say, the work is done, the wife goes out to the market, buys food the next day, prepares the food, and that's how it's done. So you skip a coin, and you're hurting people. So it's one of the things in the Old Testament that's talked about in terms of the outcry of kind of cheating people of what they've earned as being a huge sin from God. So they're doing the. So what are they praying for? I'm gonna help us with this one.
Generosity.
I'm gonna use the word justice. Justice. How about that? So this is one of the places in James where social change for social effort to make social change.
Social justice
is something that Christians are good to be a part of. So they're talking about poverty, talking about inequality in terms of races and genders and these kinds of things. So there's a place for that. So let's call it praying for justice or desiring justice, whether you're the one being mistreated or you're praying on behalf of those mistreated. Now, on the flip side of it, I think it takes people who are employers. James thinks of all his listeners as being among the downtrodden. But today, I think we need to think in terms of not just being among the downtrodden, but being among those who have the means to help others. Or if you're an employer, or if you use a babysitter, or if you, you know, all the, you're tipping at the when you go out to dinner. These kinds of things are part of our part of what we need to do to be just, demonstrate justice, even in our personal life. So, whether we're in a big business, or like I said, we just go out to dinner on occasion, you know. So, we pray. The prayer for justice is heard. What's the condition? Well, he says, reach the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. The Lord of hosts there, Lord of Sabaoth, that's the Lord of armies. That's the Lord of, that's a military God. That's a God who's going to come in and
take care of business.
Yeah, so he's thinking of the wealthy people who are own all the fields, own the land. That's where wealth was placed. And some of these people actually had their own armies, their own soldiers, too. So he thinks in terms of God coming in and destroying them. In fact, he doesn't just think of going to come in. He pictures them as already destroyed. You've fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You're in the midst of slaughter right now. I like the words that I like in Greek. It's the word fatten your hearts. They have fat hearts. And a person who is true to God has what we might say a lean heart. They have fat hearts. It's not just only their bodies might be fat because they have a luxurious lifestyle, but their inner self is spoiled, you might say, too. And he says that doesn't go over well with God, so he's going to do that. So the condition, though, probably would be in verse 6, right?
Not resisting the person who's doing the injustice.
Somewhat that. I'm actually thinking of the word righteous. In other words, that as a one crying out for justice, you also are living a life of a righteous life. And then we're back to these things. Almost, in one sense, they're almost all the same. Right?
Is 7 included or not also about being patient?
Yeah, patient and...
Well, sure.
That's what I see.
Yeah, for sure. That's right. 8, strengthen your hearts. That's the lean hearts there. It's just the fat hearts.
Take courage.
Because you mentioned that was a military term, and I'm thinking if we're patient, it's saying about basically the coming of the Lord. Oh, boy, that's... if it's the military version.
Right. This is where he says the coming of the Lord is at hand. At hand can mean has a sense of nearness to it, doesn't it? It doesn't mean it's right here. It's close. It's outside the city. It's outside the door. It's ready to move. So this is where we get this expectation of the Lord's return and judgment. It's this expectation that it's ready. Okay. 13 to 18, we have like 2 minutes left, so...
Is any one of you in trouble? You should pray. Is anyone happy? Let him sing songs of praise. Is any one of you sick? You should call the elders of the church to pray over him and anoint him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer offered in faith will make the sick person well. The Lord will raise him up. If he has sinned, he will be forgiven. Therefore, confess your sins to each other and pray for each other so that you may be healed. The prayer of a righteous man is powerful and effective. Elijah was a man just like us. He prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and it did not rain on the land for 3.5 years. Again he prayed, and the heavens gave rain, and the earth produced its crop.
There's a lot of stuff in there. But what is the main thing that's being prayed for here?
Of course, prayer for sickness.
Yeah, healing, right?
It could be for due to sin,
healing, forgiveness. Let's put it on the flip side. And again, we got the righteous. When you read these verses, though, what you see is healing via prayer, essentially. And there's the oil there, but most consider that insignificant. That's the prayer of the righteous person that's effective. And I love the part where Elijah is a person just like us. Now, we call him thinking, but he's exceptional. But he's saying he's a man.
He's human.
And he's hurt.
Is this really the first example we see of what we could call an intercessory prayer, where it's on the behalf of some other person?
It's one of the only places.
I think many of my prayers are that way.
Yeah, it's one of the only places in the New Testament. It becomes a major thing later on in the church. Intercessory prayer, that's right, on behalf of others. Now, he pictures the elders, he pictures the person who's very sick. We usually think in terms of bedridden, because they're raised up, like they're sick in bed, okay? It's like serious in the hospital kind of thing. And this is also one of the verses that, notice that the elders come into this person. The elders represent who? Probably to the church. I think they represent the church. They represent God in a way. This is really where you get the basic concept of one of the obligations of the church, the service, is to visit the sick. The pastors are supposed to go to the hospital and all that. That's how it comes out of this. And what I suggest here is that sometimes, and certainly not all the time, but sometimes people are so sick and they're so afraid of death that they have things heavy on their heart to say that would amount to confessing sin, regrets. And one of the roles of the ministers or people visiting people in these hospitals is to give them opportunity to do this, not just pray over them, in a sense, to give them a chance to unburden themselves. And here he says, it's possible that lightening your load spiritually and emotionally may help you heal. Well, we know there's studies done now that show that that's the case. That there's an emotional, at least, side to healing. That there's a perspective to healing. So this all amounts to essentially praying in a way that's in tune with God's perspective, and having building a life, life faith that moves more and more toward understanding the character of God and being more like Him, and having then Him more, what we're talking about, more in tune with what He can respond to.